Brent Lynn from the Cato Institute.
And I'm Mark Schmidt from the American Prospect Magazine.
So we wanted to start off today talking about Alito Gate.
I just made that up. I don't think there's any gate involved, but it was really...
Well, there has to be a gate.
Is what?
It has to be.
Everything's a gate, yeah.
Yes. All right, so... Well, let's talk about the kerfuffle then.
Okay. I mean, I felt like I was one. I tweeted out a little thing like, did anybody notice that Justice Alito, when in the State of the Union, when Obama talked about the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United case, that Justice Alito shook his head and said, "Not true, not true." You know, I said, "Is he the new Joe Wilson?" And then I'm surprised that that's sort of become one of the biggest stories out of the State of the Union.
So, I mean, so I think, you know, both sides are taking aim here. Obama's getting criticism for calling out the Supremes to their face, when they're invited guests to the State of the Union. He, of course, is getting called out for muttering dissent. I don't know. I'm not sure I consider either side a very big deal. First off, on the merits, I think Alito was right. I think that Obama's characterization of the opinion is just flat out factually incorrect. They've overturned or wiped out a century's worth of law and opened the floodgates for corporate influence, including foreign corporations. And I think that is incorrect on two counts. Not overturn a century's worth of law, in particular, did not touch the 100-year-old ban on direct corporate campaign contributions. Secondly, did not touch the restrictions on foreign nationals' participation in campaigns in any way. So, I think Obama just misspoke. And as a constitutional lawyer, he probably knew better. So, I think he was engaging in some not atypical demagoguery there, and Alito was correct. Alito clearly shouldn't have, I think, made a face and muttered. My guess is he had no idea he was going to be on camera. And some people are criticizing Obama not just for misstating the case, but for sort of violating some kind of penumbra surrounding the separation of powers by openly criticizing the Supreme Court case, and I don't get too worked up about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't either. I think some healthy conflict between the branches and expressing conflict in public is not a problem for me, especially when it's about an actual real issue. It's not personal or ad hominem or anything like that. Seems fine. I mean, my first reaction, of course, is to say, you know, to the justice of the Supreme Court, you know, you have this boundless power and a lifetime appointment. You can just sit still for a second and not get all worked up about this, because ultimately nobody can take that power away from you. I think a little back and forth about that is fine. I do think the decision, clearly, I mean, there's not much basis left. Heather Gerken and I did a blogging heads on this right after the decision came out. There's not much basis left for the 100-year-old ban on corporate direct contributions. The court was so affirmative in trying to wipe out a lot of the corruption rationales that have held up campaign finance law, that it's really hard to see how that stands and everything else falls. One. And two, the court said, yes, this doesn't really apply to foreign corporations, but they'll reconsider that later. I think Stevens laid out pretty clearly how it potentially applies to foreign corporations. And, you know, at what point does something become a foreign corporation? I mean, at this point, you know, Prince Alalawid of Saudi Arabia owns 30% of Citicorp. At what point does something trigger when the Saudi prince plus other foreign shareholders suddenly turned Citicorp into a foreign company, and now they're prohibited from participating in the political process. I mean, there's no structure of law that prevents that. I don't think that's, you know, I don't think that's kind of the end of the world. I don't think you want to create, I think you want some reasonable regulation on corporate involvement in the political process, that doesn't force you to make that kind of decision.
Yeah, I've heard the defenses of Obama's characterization of the case, and to me they sound very much like the conservative defenses of Palin's death panel's remark. That is, that there's a certain truthiness to the analysis that. Well, maybe there's not actual death panels, but of course the whole idea is to put the squeeze on Medicare, and there is this, you know, comparative effectiveness research stuff that is going to deny care, so it's kind of death panel-y. Uh-huh. So the fact that explicitly they didn't reach either of these issues, yes, maybe they are heading in a direction where eventually they will reach these issues, but still, both cases I think were demagoguery and misstatements of the facts, and there you go. I understand, I've read a little bit about this. I understand that Alito, fairly commonly in oral argument, makes faces and talks to himself. So it seems to be a general personality tic rather right. than a specific stunt here.
Right. But,
of course, and the easy solution to all of this is for Supremes to be no-shows for all future State of the Union addresses.
Right.
Which, I guess Souter never came, and then I understand for a while there was I don't know when this was, but there was a period when only Breyer used to show. My guess is Alito won't be there next year.
I guess that's right. I'd never actually been aware of that issue of whether you go or don't go, and Stevens apparently never goes, and Breyer always goes, which is funny because Breyer was a Senate staffer. You know, you could see it either way. I guess there were at least five there the other night. I mean, I think it doesn't really matter either way. Generally, I think when you go to, I mean, I'm not big on all the pomp around the State of the Union. If I were a member of Congress, I would not be one of those who got there, you know, who got there at 8 a.m. to be in that row where I got to shake the president's hand. But,
I heard that not only did they have to wait there for hours, but apparently they don't heat the chamber until the end. and so they were like wrapped in blankets all
right,
day,
right,
shivering.
Right. There are certain members of Congress. There are certain members of Congress that you only become aware of at that moment.
Yes, because
like
they,
Elliot Engel of the Bronx has been in that front yep. row for as long as I can remember. And you never hear his name otherwise. He has
That's
little
right.
impact on the world other than that. I'm not a big fan of all the pomp around the State of the Union, but I think generally you can go or not go, but just, especially if you're a member of the Supreme Court, just be quiet and listen. It'll be interesting. I think ultimately that one consequence of this, and of it happening in public and of it being in the news is that it really draws out, something that's, I think, kind of been under the radar in the progressive world, which is to say we really, really have to call, we really can't accept this idea that conservative justices are originalists or restrained, or Chief Justice Roberts' claim that we're just umpires who call balls and strikes. We really have to challenge the activism of the court and reclaim actually the language of constitutional fidelity for ourselves. And I think this kind of brings that into public view in a way that hasn't happened before. And I'm kind of excited about that because I think it's a very valid point, especially with a decision like that, in which whether you think it overturned 100 years or just 30 years, still went far further than it needed to. And that's really been part of the reaction to it. I mean, I think there are a lot of scholars who nobody expected a particularly favorable decision in the Citizens United case. Nobody expected it to go as aggressively far as it did in overturning two precedents and really calling into question a lot of others. I mean, if this, you know, the question about who's a judicial activist seems to me over.
Right? Mark?
Yeah?
Yeah, you cut out there for a second.
I said the question of who's a judicial activist seems to me to be over.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think it'll go on forever, don't you? and on this
rhetorical.
Score...
It was rhetorical over.
Yeah, yeah. On this score, we may just flat out disagree. But first, let's just take the case. You have a group of citizens combined together, use the corporate form to make a campaign video slamming one of the candidates. And the question is whether or not it's consistent with the First Amendment to censor that.
Okay, let's say first of all,
I cannot wrap my mind around being able to take the First Amendment seriously and think that that video ought to have been censored.
Okay, just to establish one thing, I don't think that video ought to have been censored. I think that the case should have fallen on statutory grounds. This was the law is intended to go after a particular kind of, you know, blasted out TV ad that, you know, the kind that we saw in 96 and 98. This wasn't even a TV ad. It was people who watched it voluntarily. It wasn't really intended to influence the election that it happened to appear near. I mean, it was intended to be a kind of test case. And as a test case, there was no reason. It was really an overreach by the FEC, and that should have been called earlier. It should have been called at some point as it went up. Except that people wanted to use this as a test case.
Okay, so in this particular case, we agree that this particular bit of political speech shouldn't have been censored.
Absolutely.
I go much farther than that, though, in that I don't think political speech of any kind should be censored. And so whether it's, you know, the kinds of TV ads you're talking about, the idea that people can't, that private citizens can't combine together and speak their mind about a candidate within 60 days of an election is just, I can't for the life of me see how that isn't just a complete assault on the First Amendment.
I actually agree with you that particular provision of McCain-Feingold, which had been mostly eviscerated anyway, I don't disagree with you, and I think that the problem it was trying to solve is kind of an old problem anyway. Where you had you know, in 96, 98, people weren't getting any political information from the internet. You know, there's a block of people who are, they're going to vote, but they're not paying much attention, and these you know, fake issue ads that said call Congressman Jones and ask him why he's always raising taxes or whatever, you know, had a huge impact.
Right.
And they were a way of evading the other limits. Now we have a situation where there are other ways of other ways of raising money, as well as other ways of communicating with voters. Those things aren't as big, you know, the need for it isn't as significant. And it was pretty dubious, anyway, and it was almost gone. So, I think there's an interesting point here also, which is, you know, you define it, and I kind of agree with this, that, you know, a group of you define it as a group of people getting together to do this, and I think that's right. Actually quite an important distinction, because there's people often say, well, a corporation means ExxonMobil. Well, a corporation could also be Citizens United itself, or a corporation could be MoveOn.org, or a corporation could be the American Prospect.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's the only in this any kind of thing, whether we're aggregating purely for economic purposes or for purposes of you know, doing political speech, is in the form of a corporation. So incorporation means so many different things in our society that I think that adds just complexity to the case.
Yeah, and then of course a corporation can also be the New York Times or GE owning NBC,
right.
Or
right. I mean there is a kind of media exception here.
Yeah, but that question of you know, why a media corporation is okay and why other corporations aren't okay, then I don't get it. I don't get why journalists have completely unrestricted ability to engage in people we call journalists, which includes, you know, people on Fox and MSNBC, who aren't journalists at all, they're just, you know, hacks, they get unlimited capacity to influence public opinion and influence the outcome of elections, and other people don't. So that distinction between media corporations and other folks using the corporate form eludes me when it comes to the First Amendment. And I guess it eluded five justices on the Supreme Court, which is why they had to overturn the Michigan case. They had to, if they agreed with me, and maybe to some extent you, that the McCain-Feingold provision was just a violation of the First Amendment, then they pretty much had to overturn that section of the McConnell decision, which had upheld that provision of McCain-Feingold. So that bit of judicial activism was just in the cards, of making the decision on constitutional grounds. And then the Michigan case, I think, again, is, correctly decided. It was correct to overrule it because I can't see a distinction between media corporations and other corporations. Yes, they overturned two precedents. That's activist. You can define that as activism, but we all have our good activism and our bad activism. When the Warren Court was overturning precedents left and right, it was good activism. When the Roberts Court is overturning some, maybe it's bad activism, but I find the whole activist restraint language just completely bogus and tiresome and empty of any content other than as a mask for what you want.
Okay. Well, I mean, I do think Austin, the Michigan case, which banned corporate independent spending, had a very different quality than most of the other decisions around campaign finance. And I think when I did this Blogging Hands last week with Heather Gerken, she said she always told her students that Austin was a goner, that at some point it was going to be overturned.
Gotcha. Yeah,
I think that the problem in this case is the overstretch to reach cases that didn't need to be reached, and also to really undermine the foundations of other precedents that really are not that really are problematic. I mean, I think if the court had just gone in and overturned Austin specifically,
I mean, you can absolutely say that that Roberts' stated ambition to decide cases as narrowly as possible and to seek, you know, unanimous or near unanimous decisions as frequently as possible, was either disingenuous at the outset, or he has come to realize, or he has just failed in his ambitions.
Right. And I'm betting on disingenuous at the outset, but you know, we'll await some great insider history of the Roberts Court to really be sure about that. And then I noticed from an email that Larry Lessig, who's been a big advocate of campaign finance reform, came to and gave a talk at Cato the other day.
Yes,
we saw him at dinner later that day. Did he convert any of the libertarians to the cause of public financing, which is how I think these issues ought to be addressed?
He didn't. And we, even though there were, 15 of us and only one of him, we didn't seem to convert him either. We had a nice exchange, and he's a smart guy. I know your approach to these issues is more speech is better, and so the way to address issues of kind of inequality of voice is to amplify the voices that aren't getting heard so well now, rather than to squelch the voices that are getting heard loud and clear now. And I absolutely think that is the better course. I remain deeply skeptical about public financing schemes to the extent that they seek to put an overall limit on the amount of spending in campaigns and thereby basically still act to squelch speech. Mm-hmm. If what you're doing instead is something where you've got like these kind of vouchers where you give everybody money so that they can contribute, so you're subsidizing political participation, that strikes me as, you know, not very a small government libertarian, but much better. It's just a pure, straight up subsidization of speech without any kind of attempts to, without being animated at all by this idea that that there's too much political advocacy going on and we need to cut it down to size.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I've always felt that chant of there's too much money in politics is really the wrong way to think about it, because you can have a situation, and this was kind of what was going on in the late 90s. You can have a situation where there's not that much money in politics, but what there is really, really hard to get because, you know, yes, just nobody's really motivated to give and the contribution limits are pretty low, so that when you get somebody to give, they can't give that much, which it gives real advantage to certain people who can finance their own campaigns and things like that. And B, creates huge incentives for evasion, to go out and find the corporations or individuals who can put big money behind independent expenditures. On the one hand, you can imagine on the other hand, a situation where, you know, every candidate is a little Obama, right? With lots of small contributors and enthusiasm, yeah, and people throwing money at them, and you might have vastly more money in total in politics, but it's happening in a whole different way. So the get money approach has never seemed right to me.
Yeah, I think the great mystery is why there is so little money in politics.
Right.
I mean, now we have a regulatory regime that makes it harder to spend. But before we had that, we still had a gigantic government with the stakes being absolutely staggeringly huge, and yet just chump change spent on elections.
Right.
And so that's interesting. So I'm with you that technological changes may very well be taking some of the hot air out of this debate. That as concerns about voice abate with the evident capacity of small donors to get together and do something meaningful, as happened clearly in the Obama campaign. It wasn't the whole story, but it was definitely a big part of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, frankly, as the historical disadvantage of the Democratic Party in fundraising goes away.
And particularly in small donor fundraising, where the Republicans always have a huge advantage, you know, the old ladies who write those checks every month.
Then, you know, with the continuing game of squeezing the balloon that we have with 30-something years of campaign finance regulation producing such unsatisfactory results, then maybe eventually we can move to a system that's more like the one that that you'd like to have.
All right. In place. Good. What a good level of agreement here. What was that? What was next on our? Were we going to talk about the State of the Union?
Well, let's go back to the State of the Union, right, and the high drama that fed into that, which is basically the collapse of the Obama dream.
Right.
So if Roberts pledged that he was going to end bickering on the court in 5-4 decisions and bring everybody together in a trans-ideological little narrow majorities, Obama promised to end the red-blue bickering and transcend partisan rancor and bring us all together and get things done. And he's failed on both counts. We have more toxic political polarization than ever, and he's had a series of spectacular belly flops in getting his agenda through Congress.
Right.
Most spectacularly, the goal line fumble of health care reform, which now, I guess, looks pretty close to dead.
Right, right.
And the reason it's dead is not just that they lost the 60th senator, but how they lost the 60th
right.
senator, losing him in a Massachusetts by-election, getting, you know, Teddy Kennedy's seat filled now by a Republican pledged to stop the Obama health care legislation. That's all just such an astonishing turn of events, and clearly the results in Massachusetts are seem to be indicative of a broader national backlash against at least the agenda of the Democratic Congress, if not President Obama personally. And it's got Democrats in red states, or even Democrats in blue states without overwhelming leads, extremely scared for their political lives. And therefore, I think you've got a lot of, it's highly unlikely that you're going to get those marginal votes for healthcare reform that you that right. you got over the course of the fall. This then, the State of the Union coming right after all these shockwaves, was an opportunity for Obama maybe to, you know, turn Clintonian or pivot or reset or one of these pundit cliches. I don't think he did that at all. I thought it looked like kind of full steam ahead on conventional big government liberalism. And so I don't see any resolution of his problems in sight.
All right. Well, that's a large analysis of the whole situation, most of which I think is right. The problem is that Obama had two approaches. One was, can you do something that gets you to a somewhat more bipartisan place? And with the, you know, with the right. support that he had in the campaign from people like Senator Lugar, you know, you felt like maybe there were the beginnings of that. And then there really was that slamming on
and,
the brakes.
And his rhetoric, and you know, which was explicitly postpartisan, and just his demeanor and temperament, which was, you know, so modulated and thoughtful and giving credit to the weight of the other side of the argument, all seemed like a style that might go with a genuinely new kind of politics.
And I think he's somebody who, I think I've said this before, he actually didn't just say, where's a Republican that's liberal enough that I can deal with? He really tried to take conservatism itself seriously. And those, you know, those props that he gave to Reagan, which became a big issue during the Democratic campaign, I always thought were genuinely correct. And I think, genuinely felt in that he thought there was something of value to, you know, not without being a Reaganite, I think he thought there was something of value and interest in what Reagan brought, and I'm gonna get myself in trouble if I say that any further. But that was the spending several months trying to get some bipartisan agreement in the Finance Committee, and kind of encouraging Senator Baucus to take that approach, and not being, you know, being a little bit hands off and letting members of Congress work towards that bipartisan approach. That path A. In the end, didn't work because of the simple party line discipline on the Republican side. Path B was to say, you know, you have 60 votes, you have them for a reason, use them. And I think Path B was closed not just by the election in Massachusetts, but by the fact that it's such a vulnerable 60 votes. And Senator Biden said this, Vice President Biden said this the other day, and it sounded just like the piece that I'd written right after the Massachusetts election. He said, you know, 60 votes weren't such a blessing after all. Because the price of getting to the 60 votes, the price of buying off Senator Nelson and Senator Landrieu and Joe Lieberman, was so corrupting that that's all that happened in Massachusetts. You know, if you look at the Washington Post poll, you can't find a person who can say, here's the substantive reason I didn't like health care reform. I didn't like this provision. They, in Massachusetts, they actually could have a good substantive reason, which is, we already got this. Why are we paying it for it in other states?
We don't like it so much, right?
But you didn't even hear that very much. I mean, that's all Brown really. Yeah. That was kind of what Brown was saying at some point. But all you heard was about process. And Karen Tumulty at the Time said that, you know, when she was up there, that's all she heard about was the Cornhusker kickback. So what you have was a situation where, in order to get the people who call themselves conservative Democrats, you had to buy them off with crap that made the bill look like the worst of liberalism, you know, the worst of just throwing money around in a kind of cheap, small, and corrupting way. And at that point, people's natural anxiety about health care, because anything involving health you're anxious about, begins to feel validated. You know, what is this plan really going to look like if it's bought with such cheap stuff? So, you know, both paths were closed for interesting reasons. Now, sometimes you could say we've always at the Prospect, we've run lots of articles that take the form Obama understood what went wrong in the Hillary Clinton health plan and learned the lessons, and maybe he overlearned the lessons. So like Clinton wrote the plan in the White House, he let Congress do its work. Clinton tried right. to change the whole system. He and Hillary Clinton in the campaign before him, he just insisted on this assurance that, you know, if you like what you have, nothing will ever change, which of course has a problem on the other side, which is when people keep hearing that, all you naturally assume, well, this is a plan for basically poor people. It doesn't have, you know, it's an expensive plan that won't improve my life at all. And there are a couple other things like that. And at some point you sort of say, okay, if these things are mistakes and these things, and then the other doing the opposite is a mistake, maybe you just can't get health reform done in this country. You know, maybe that's just yeah. impossible. And, you know, health reform has always been the big thing for progressives. That's the thing that there's lots of interesting domestic policies we want to do. But when we talk about big ideas, ambitious policies, really always going to come back to health reform. And maybe there's just always going to be something that makes it impossible to do that, and also knocks you back on your heels for a little while in the way that it did Clinton. I mean, health reform wasn't the only thing in the early Clinton years that knocked him back, and it's not the only thing here, because the bailouts are a huge, I think, background to people's feelings about government right now. But if I were Obama, I almost feel like there's a little bit of an instinct here. Part of it is like, was it so smart to go out so quickly on health reform? You know, maybe that's not the way to do that first year. It's another path not taken. We'll wait for another 20 years. We'll have a Democrat who'll face the same question.
Yeah, I think the fatal flaw in the progressive you know, quixotic quest for healthcare reform is not the goal. The goal of ensuring that people can get at least basic medical care without regard to ability to pay. The goal of ensuring that people aren't wiped out financially because they get sick. The goal of ensuring that people don't lose their access to health care because they've lost their job. I think all of those are completely appropriate goals. And I think the current healthcare financing system is just a terrible mess. It seems to me that progressives can't get it out of their heads that the way to ensure better access to healthcare is to do it through even greater government controls over the healthcare financing markets. So rather than we don't have any problems, or we have comparatively few problems ensuring that people get enough food, but we don't do it by government taking over or having some incredibly arcane, complex system of subsidies and mandates for the grocery store business. We just have an unregulated grocery store industry, and we give people food stamps.
And a heavily subsidized agriculture sector.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I think we could get rid of those subsidies, and we'd still have incredibly cheap food. And for people who couldn't afford it, we've got food stamps.
I think the problem, the only problem
but,
with that
but,
is,
but, you're not so the, talking so the, about, the, pa- the pa- okay, let me, let me, let me just finish, the, let me just finish this point. So the path not taken is a truly hybrid approach, which is, taking a real step in the free market direction of seeing that health insurance markets can work for regular people and, deregulating those, seeing that the employer provided, system is crazy and we ought to be moving away from it, seeing that most people don't need that that kind of extravagant subsidy, or at least the subsidy as it is offered today is one that that isn't very progressive.
Right.
And then having a you know trying to create as clean and well functioning a private insurance marketplace as possible, and then subsidizing people who can't afford it. Just that seems to me so obviously the right policy way to go, but it doesn't ever even get taken seriously on the progressive side. And I'm not saying it would be easy. I mean, I think you are right to be sort of near, you know, to be deeply pessimistic about the prospects of rational healthcare reform at this stage, because I think what the public wants is impossible. It wants to be insulated from costs. It doesn't want to have to think about how much things cost. It likes first dollar coverage. It wants complete freedom to choose doctors and procedures, and it wants costs to stay under control. And you can't have all three. Something's going to have to give. Mm-hmm. On the free market side, you'd have to convince people that to accept probably catastrophic high deductible coverage and have to pay for a lot more of your medical bills than you used to pay. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be, you know, a bitter pill to swallow. Right. Politically. On your side, you have to convince people the government is going to somehow or another exert control over costs in a way that doesn't sound like rationing or death panels, and that didn't go over very well this time, as it hasn't gone over in the past. And so we're both stuck because the public wants a big, huge free lunch, and thus far nobody has successfully educated the public that it's not available.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of things. There's two kinds of things. There's what the public wants, and there's what you can scare people about.
Yes.
And I think you want to separate those a bit. I mean, there's a huge amount of cost control that could be done that wouldn't drive people crazy in practice, but can be turned into some kind of thing. And we should be clear about that. I mean, I don't know that just going back to your, you know, idea, but I mean, I just don't see how far this kind of bill is from what you have in mind. An insurance market that works for everybody is one that has some fundamental regulations to it, because insurance is not like food. It's as if the grocery store were kind of checking you out every time you came and had lots of incentives to the hungrier you were to send you away. That's the way that market works. And you sort of have to have a little bit of regulation that says you have to provide insurance to people even if they're, you know, the equivalent of hungry. And just all insurance markets have to be structured markets. There's really no way around that. And I think people can accept, lots of people can accept high dollar catastrophic policies, but it's going to be tough to build a market that also works for people with chronic conditions and lower incomes, in that kind of system. So I mean, I just think the insurance regulations and the cost controls were the biggest part you had left of this bill, and then the subsidies that got people into them. And I think this is the free market bill. I keep saying that, and I don't, you know, I think that the conservatives' kind of willful refusal to accept that this is what you get when you try to construct a workable market for health insurance and get people into it. I mean, the alternative would have been something like the Wyden-Bennett bill, which would have thrown out much more of the existing system, maybe matched up with some of your interests and had nominally a bunch of Republican co-sponsors. But this isn't that, you know, once you're taking the public plan away and the Medicare buy-in and all that stuff, I just don't see how this bill as it stands far away.
My complaints with the current system are much deeper and more radical than that. I don't think we have a health insurance market at all right now.
I think
we have a prepaid medical expenses market.
Right.
And that's different, right? That's just that first dollar or low dollar coverage is not insurance. It's like having car insurance that covers fill-ups and
right,
It just doesn't, or, you know, or having food insurance. It just doesn't make, it doesn't make sense for routine, predictable, expenses to be insured. But because of this crazy path dependent process we're, you know, we're on ever since World War II, price controls and wage controls and, a workaround was to exempt healthcare benefits from being part of individual income. Ever since that, we've got this crazy system where, you've got, this prepaid health, insurance being subsidized by, favorable tax treatment. And, even though it's part of compensation and it, and the higher the costs are for this kind of prepaid healthcare, the lower your wages are going to be, employees don't see it that way. They see the healthcare that they get as free. And so you have just at the original sin is just a bunch of, is a terrible subsidy and a complete derangement of the marketplace. And until the employer provided, element and the low dollar coverage element are addressed, I don't think you have anything like what a free market in health insurance would look like. And how to get there from here, God knows. Right. But I don't think that, the legislation that was, that has just apparently died, was going to bring us any closer to that. And, you know, I thought cagily and correctly, Obama in his, was it September healthcare speech before the joint session? He presented his approach as sort of sensible centrism. On the left, you've got these single payer guys and there's a logic and an attractiveness to that. And on the right, you've got these people who think we should move away from the employer provided system and have, try to create a real individual healthcare market. But me, I'm a pragmatist. I think most people are pretty happy with the system we've got now, and so I think we ought to build on it.
Right.
And that's right. That's the conservative, without ideological, just real conservative move. Unfortunately, when the whole system is at least to my way of thinking, just fundamentally misconceived, conservative reforms are doomed.
We'll
never get to find out though.
Yeah, I used to be very sympathetic to the idea of, strip out the employers completely. It's crazy that we provide this through the employer. And that critique that, basically what you're saying is part of our system, when you get your health insurance from your employer, part of it is essentially prepaid of ordinary things, and part of it is real insurance, and the real insurance part should be treated as real insurance, which also kind of makes sense in an economic way. It's not bad to have the other part prepaid simply because you're more likely to use it and do the preventive things that make it less likely that you're going to have big costs on the other side. So again, once you dig into it, I'm not sure I want to totally get rid of that. It doesn't seem the end of the world to have some things that to make sure you do those things, therefore have them prepaid. If you had your every 6 months auto, oil change and so forth,
right,
prepaid, you'd be more likely to do it. Those aren't bad. It seems to me the things that people do with the bottom dollars are not bad or wasteful things for the most part. That's not where the waste is in the health system, number one. So I kind of come to terms with that. And after a while, I also kind of came to realize, it's a big deal to throw out the employer completely out of the health insurance system simply because that delivery process, that process you go through when you take a new job where the human resources person says, here's the five plans you can choose from and pretty much everybody chooses this one and that's why you should do this and I'm going to sign you up and you're going to, if you didn't have that person, if you yourself had to go and you had 20 plans and figure this out, a lot of people are just not going to do it.
I agree with that.
But that employer role, that's where most people are, and that's the best way to get them.
Right. And right. And so that's, we have this history, and people are used to going to their employer for health insurance options. And so I think the key is to move the tax preference from the corporation from the being employed to the individual.
Right.
So if the individual, regardless of where he's employed, has this tax credit or whatever, then sure, maybe employers will continue to offer health insurance and he can choose from that array of plans, or maybe over time some other aggregators will come along to offer, a suite of plans. Who knows? But anyway, that's all, far off in the future. I wanted to go beyond just healthcare, because I think Obama's failure to achieve a new postpartisan politics goes beyond healthcare. And so just let me speak as as a libertarian who voted for Obama, and, not so much because I really had very high hopes about his domestic policy agenda. I voted for him because I thought, that the Republicans had just made a complete hash of things and they needed to be kicked out and the other guys needed to turn, even if I thought they were likely to screw up too.
You're a great fatalistic libertarian.
So my reaction was throw the bums out and give somebody else a try. But I had some hopes because of what we talked about earlier, his rhetoric and style and temperament, that perhaps he might be able to bridge some ideological differences in surprising ways once the campaign was over. But in the first couple of months, those hopes were just completely dashed. First, the stimulus bill, which I think was just a complete piece of garbage. It was turned over to Congress and was basically just an accumulation of Democratic spending wish lists that had been building up for years, much of which didn't go, in the first year or two, and therefore wasn't effective stimulus at all. To me, it just looked like big government liberalism as usual. Then with his quasi State of the Union address laying out, what to me looked like just 150 proof, big government liberal agenda with card check and the cap and trade legislation and nothing, really nothing that seemed to indicate that he did really take conservative or libertarian ideas on economic policy seriously. He lost me. I realized he was just a big government liberal and that he was trying to sound like a postpartisan moderate. And it seems that the electorate has come to a similar conclusion, and that's not what they thought they voted for.
Okay.
He's had the most precipitous fall in public opinion support of any president we know of, and his agenda has gone into a ditch, and he's scrambling right now.
Well, I think the agenda was the same thing that people voted for. The question was whether you could set out that agenda and bring people together behind it in Congress in the same way that you were able to bring people together behind that agenda as well as the person, on the campaign trail. Little bit affected, the need for some kind of economic stimulus was a bipartisan, it was understood across the board, and kind of take what you can get in a stimulus bill. But after that, it was fundamentally the agenda that he campaigned on, and the question was whether you could make that something in which there was a conversation about how you do it. Is there a bipartisan? Maybe there still is room for the bipartisan conversation about how you do cap and trade or some other form of climate change legislation. Since again, you have Senator Lindsey Graham and others who are engaged with that. But but for the most part, there was never a joining of the conversation, and that's what always drove me crazy. Like at the beginning of the healthcare debate or anything, everything became just like death panels. There are death panels in this bill. We have to throw the whole bill out. What happened to the process where you said, we share a common goal, There are four provisions in this bill that I object to. Therefore, I'm going to offer amendments to have the death penalty provision, whatever, you know, whatever you decided that was, which nobody ever seemed to be clear about. You know, we're offering an amendment to remove that because this is what it is to govern. This is what it is. That's what never happened. And I think that that's the story of the, that's the expectation that he had sort of naively that he could force that to happen again. Because if that doesn't happen, I don't know where we are with any agenda in this country.
Let me throw in one aggravating and one factor that I forgot to mention, and then one mitigating factor. The aggravating factor is also early on was the takeover of the auto industry and the I think thuggish and lawless screwing of secured creditors to help out organized labor in the ensuing deals. That was all just so heavy-handed government. Running industries, telling GM who its CEO should be, telling Chrysler who it should merge with. It was just was so old style, command and control that, I just couldn't believe it was happening. And might I mention along those lines, when I heard, Obama, a couple of nights ago, announcing a 5-year plan to double our exports. I really couldn't believe that this is.
Which apparently came straight out of the Chamber of Commerce. That's basically what the Chamber has been asking for.
Well,
that's for your guy. That's for your guys, Brink.
Yeah. they're not my guys.
Your guys.
Anyway, the idea first, a guy who's, got, a socialism problem, announcing 5-year plans. That's just not very clever. and second, the idea that, anybody has any idea how to double exports in 5 years is.
It was a stupid
line. It's just cockamamie.
As I understand it, it does come straight from, this was what the Chamber of Commerce has been asking the president to do.
Well, then shame on them. and shame on Obama for listening to them on that.
Right.
Not the fact that there was a stimulus bill, but what it was in it and how it was managed, that was a huge turnoff. The fact that he decided to campaign on his entire agenda in the first year or tried to push his whole campaign agenda through in the first year, that was rattling. And then third, the auto takeover, I thought it was just revolting. But the backdrop, I think, is that, he came in the midst of an economic cataclysm where there had been these huge emergency measures taken, you can argue about, how they were engineered or how they were implemented, the TARP and all the extraordinary Fed actions. But I think there was a fundamental misread on the part of the administration that this crisis was something that ought not to go to waste and that this was an opportunity to actually have a bolder policy agenda than they might otherwise have envisioned possible. And so let's try to do the whole campaign agenda in the first year.
Right.
When in fact all this tumult and all the extraordinary policy measures that were taken in response to it had people freaked out.
Right.
It was freaking people out that you're bailing out banks and all these extraordinary measures were being taken, and it freaked people out that debt was going up through the roof. And so, in fact, he faced, I think, a more constrained political environment because of the circumstances that he came in on, and quite the opposite of what he thought. And so, I think that, he couldn't help the circumstances that attended his election and coming into office, but he misread them, I think.
Right.
And I
think that's right.
And I overreached.
I think I don't agree with you about all the individual pieces, but that's not important. I mean, as a libertarian, you should be outraged by the auto industry bailout. And from my point of view, I'm sort of more worried about what would have happened without it. But leave that aside.
Yep.
I think the basic analysis is right. There were two stories that people would tell about what might happen. And the one is the FDR story. You know, you act quickly on the emergency and then you have just momentum and energy to kind of move through the more permanent, the more lasting things that really have to happen. And I think the reality is, we don't live in FDR's world anymore, where in fact government was kind of There was a little bit of a backdoor nature to it. He was the only person communicating to the American people, really, at that time. I mean, there were there was this agitation from the right, but it wasn't reaching people in the same way that in the same way that Glenn Beck and so forth do. So it's more the debate is more out there for a whole bunch of reasons. Instead of getting momentum, what you got was exhaustion. You got exhaustion on Capitol Hill, mirrored by exhaustion and nervousness in the public. You throw health reform into the mix, which exacerbates that, and you get a kind of like stop feeling, which I think is what we got with the Massachusetts election and so forth. And then you start over, with the kind of the smaller pieces. And I wrote about this after the State of the Union. I said that I thought the debate in progressive circles has always been, it's not so much, you know, liberal, moderate or populist, non-populist. It's, you know, the big versus the small. People like me, I'm always in the camp that says we need the big, the grand bargain, the big move forward. You know, and it can be a bipartisan, you know, you can think of the bipartisan grand bargain, but you need the big agenda. I worked on Bill Bradley's presidential campaign. Our whole argument was Clintonism was too small. We needed big ideas. And, you know, mainly that would be health reform. There was always the big side, and the small side said, well, you know, we'll do 15 tax credits here and do a little bit of this and this population. That was, you know, the things that the middle period of Clintonism was all defined by those small initiatives. And I, you know, the way I put it after the State of the Union was, you know, small won. And we're back to small. Or I think I wrote that Obama signed a non-aggression pact with small. And that's what we're going to be doing right now, which is the pieces that are manageable enough for people to understand, kind of paced out. You know, there's a long way to go here in this administration, and you can actually, in the end, you can achieve a lot with small. So I'm almost I'm willing to see that change happen, and I'm willing to kind of stick with Obama through that, which probably marks me. I sometimes get called an Obama bot by commenters on our blog and so forth. And I may be guilty of that if I'm willing to change my whole theory of politics, just accommodate it. But, you know, I don't really see any other. I don't see any path back to the kind of big initiatives moved aggressively.
Yeah, I mean, we have, you know, the problem is we have big problems, right. And most of this small bore stuff, I think, is just gimmickry designed to create the impression that politicians are doing something about problems rather than actually having any real important public policy significance. So I think the contempt that, you know, big deal progressives have for Clintonism is understandable, that there are big problems and those little small bore policies don't get at. The where we are right now, I think, is both neither side is capable of addressing the big problems in a politically viable way. And I know you hear a lot of progressives these days saying it's the system's fault. Some of them, you know, blame the Senate and the filibuster, and then of course there's always blaming money in politics. But I don't really believe the system is to blame. We've had something like this system, which is designed to make change difficult for a long, long time, and sometimes good things happen. I feel like our politics is broken. I feel like the current conceptualization of the right is intellectually bankrupt and not serious about governing. It's much more about striking poses. I think that the contemporary left is serious about governing, but its ideas are deeply wrongheaded, and also not capable of winning the kind of broad public acceptance you need to actually get them legislated. So I feel like we're stuck. And yes, we're doing the small bore stuff, and that's going to create the impression of activity. But I don't think it's a satisfactory alternative. I think what we need is somehow or another to come up with either a left or a right that is capable of attacking big problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, I think
but it ain't happening this year.
No, it's not happening right now. And the right, and of course, as the right has become a smaller piece of the mix. And you know, an interesting thing is that in order to kind of cast off George W. Bush and the legacy of that administration, it's really been helpful for the Republican right to go further right. I mean, they've really kind of, we've forgotten about George W. Bush and a kind of, you know, he caused all these problems argument kind of falls flat when the Republican Party is now, you know, the face of the Republican Party are really people who had nothing to do with the Bush administration other than Dick Cheney's daughter turning up on TV all the time. You know, it's a whole new set of faces. And by being further right and further out of the political process, you know, disengaged, they're able to kind of get away with that to some extent. But I mean, I think the two go to, I mean, I think if you had a Republican, I'm naive enough and Obama-ish enough to believe that if you had a Republican right that was willing to engage in the process of governing, you know, even, I mean, I think our ideas are fine, but to the extent that you think they're not fine, that process would improve those ideas, you know, and all of that was possible this year, but it didn't happen. And I'm actually not really willing to put that much responsibility on the left, for that, other than I think maybe for the misreading of how much you could do after you'd done these things on the immediate crisis. But
yeah, I mean, I think the right is a disgrace these days. I don't think it's a disgrace for opposing Obama's agenda. I think it's a disgrace for having no ideas of its own. But there's where it is. And we've been talking for an hour.
We've been over an hour. Blogging Heads pays us by the hour. We don't want to go into a second hour and cost them, you know, vastly more money.
Exactly, but delightful to talk to you, and look forward to doing it again sometime, and maybe. Well, of course, there'll be something to talk about, but maybe something will actually have changed.
Something positive that you could be. I want you to be less fatalistic.
I'd like to be.
Yeah.
I'm an optimist at heart.
All right.
All right, Mark. Nice talking to you.
Okay, good. Likewise, Greg. Bye-bye.